Welcome to the V3 Podcast with Dr. Ann Arvizu. Medical affairs innovators are changing the game for business success and making the world a better place for our patients. On the V3 Podcast, we showcase the vision, the voice, and the value of medical affairs. Each month, join host Dr. Ann Arvizu, a globally recognized medical affairs subject matter expert and awarded biotech industry executive veteran, for powerful interviews with today's acclaimed innovators and founders who are leading the profession forward into a new era. These high-level conversations will leave you inspired and equipped with future-focused ideas for changing culture and making an impact. And now, here's Ann.
Welcome back to another episode of the V3 Podcast. This is the vision, the voice, and the value of medical affairs. And this is your host, Ann Arvizu. And my guest today, I'm excited to announce, is Dr. William Solomon. He's the president of the Accreditation Council for Medical Affairs, or ACMA. He's the chairman and CEO of the ACMA, and he's considered by many to be a pharmacy industry futurist. He's been featured, especially this year, on a lot of news media outlets like Fox News, Forbes, Al Jazeera, Yahoo Business TV, ABC News Radio, and the Boston Herald. Will has 20 years of experience in the pharmaceutical industry, working within medical affairs across several companies, and he's passionate about transforming the industry through benchmarking and technology. The ACMA is most famous for the Board Certified Medical Affairs Specialist, or BCMAS, as some of us who have our board certification know it as. And this is the program which is the first and only board certification for MSLs and medical affairs professionals in the world. It's now in over 40 countries. And the ACMA also provides other tech and analytical solutions for the life sciences industry. Dr. Solomon received his doctoral training at Columbia University, his undergraduate degree from New York University, and he is an interesting and fast and quick person to talk to. He always has great answers. So I'm excited for you to join us in progress in our interview today, where we're going to talk about what are the trends that we're seeing that just left us in 2019, and where do we go from here in 2020? What is the 2020 vision that we really need to capture to be successful in an ever-changing world with rocky ground that we've just left some very negative trust issues behind? It's time for, as he says, a facelift for pharma. So let 2020 be the year that we shine, that we connect with patients like never before, and that we expand together for the right reasons and for the good of all. Join us in progress. Hi, Will. How are you?
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm great. Good to talk with you. And we're going to have an interesting conversation today. Look, a little look back at 2019 to see what we could learn and a little visionary look forward. So I'm excited for our conversation today.
Yeah, same here. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
You're welcome. You're welcome. It's an honor and pleasure to have you. So if we look back at 2019, there have been some documented trends for 2019. One of them is drug pricing and the affordability of healthcare. Another is moving closer to value-based healthcare. A third is realizing the full value of AI, which, you know, we talked about in a previous episode of the V3 Podcast, and how we can actually put that to work in the industry, because people are like, yeah, I know AI is out there, but how do we actually use it in medical affairs? And there's some applications that are more obvious than others in terms of controlling patient data, et cetera. Another trend has been patient input becomes, as I4Pharma calls it, business as normal. You know, you and I were at the 2019 Rare Disease Forum in Philadelphia, and there were people in the room, including myself, that have been in medical affairs for over 20 years and never knew that the zebra was kind of that symbol for rare disease. And I had worked in four or five rare disease companies. And then the fifth trend would be moving beyond randomized clinical trials. So as we look back to these trends, I'm going to add another one because that's kind of like a top five list that's out there and And many articles have been written on all of these topics. But, you know, patient centricity, we're talking about number four as being the patient, getting their input. That's been something that you and I talked about, and we talked about at that forum. And then the sixth that I will add to this conversation is the big guys buying out the little guys. There have been more mergers and acquisitions in 2019 than ever. I think we're over the 250 mark of smaller companies being bought out. And I hate to be a skeptic, but I kind of see little companies being created, a small biotech startup being created just for the sale later on. So let's talk about some of those topics. I know that you have a very big, broad view of the industry, having been the founder of ACMA, being so steeped in and around medical affairs. So what have you seen so far in 2019 regarding, let's start with drug pricing?
Sure. There's a lot of hot topics there.
Yes.
So, you know, in terms of drug pricing, obviously now, I think one of the biggest things that is an area of focus for everybody is what's happening on the Hill, right? With the plan that's being put forth by Nancy Pelosi and looking at, you know, what that could mean for the industry. In general, I think, you know, one of the things we need to be careful with, especially as we're, you know, going into an election year now, is, you know, what does this actually mean for the industry from an innovation perspective? You know, so one of the things, of course, that's also being talked about is like Medicare for All, and, you know, what is that going to mean for pharmaceutical companies around innovating, around competition within the industry? And so I think, you know, when it comes to drug pricing, obviously, you know, there's no doubt that we want to try to make, you know, as many drugs as affordable as possible. Yes. For patients, right? I think we would all agree to that. I think the challenge comes in, as you know, look at an area, for example, like oncology, where the statistics show that about 95% of clinical trials in oncology fail. They fail. And so, you know, the challenge is, you know, there's a big upfront cost, a huge investment that goes into trying to build out and put these clinical trials together, and with the hopes that you're going to be able to get approval for your product or device or what it would be. And then if that doesn't pan out, you're kind of back to the drawing board. So I think part of the solution around drug pricing, from my perspective, maybe to think about it differently, is thinking about more efficient and effective ways to design clinical trials. And you kind of mentioned, you know, when you— Yes. —were going through the list of hot topics and issues within the industry, you mentioned things like analytics, technology, AI, you know, machine— Yes. —learning, things like that. That's where I think this comes into play, right? So you think about something like blockchain technology and what that could mean for clinical trial design, or when it comes to clinical trial automation. So these are, I think, ways in which the industry can probably do a better job of leveraging these types of technologies, so that we are designing studies that are much more efficient, with the right patient population, and maybe finding out earlier that, you know what, this might not be a product that's, or a molecule that's going to make it, right? And maybe stop earlier in the process before investing so much. Right. So I think it's a lot about those efficiencies and leveraging the technology to maybe help abate some of the drug pricing issues that are out there.
Right. And it might be a case of easier said than done, wouldn't you think? So it's a big trial in a big train, like a Pfizer or, you know, another top big pharma, is a lot harder to slow down and stop when so many systems are in place, versus a small biotech that's scrappy, young, lean, agile, and kind of ready to pivot into another direction a little bit quicker. And, you know, the cost is so high to create a drug, and people don't truly realize that. In biotech, it's beyond drug, it's product, it's gene therapy, et cetera. So, you know, you touched on basically three of our hot topics all in one in your answer, with, you know, realizing the full value of AI and moving beyond these randomized clinical trials. It is something for our listeners to think about, because the way forward, I believe, in the face of AI, in the face of mainstream AI, is to become far more fluid than we've been in the past. Would you agree to that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, it really comes down to understanding how do you leverage technology, of course, in an ethical and compliant manner, but to help really address the question that you have and, you know, ultimately whether or not this device or product is going to work. But again, to do that earlier, you know, in the development of the drug. And I think that is really critical going back to this issue of drug pricing, which ultimately also affects from a policy perspective, something like, you know, Medicare for all, right? And thinking about, okay, you know, in theory, it's a great concept, but what does that actually mean in terms of how we apply it? And so I think there's a strong intercalation between what's happening at the industry level, you know, whether it's within R&D or, you know, as you know, obviously I'm very passionate about medical affairs and what we do, but even earlier on in the process, as well as what's happening on the Hill, you know, from a political standpoint, and thinking about different policies and systems that we can put into place to make the overall healthcare system a little bit more efficient and effective.
Right. You know, you and I have both been executives in the industry and have held roles. And you know that when you're in like a lead role for a senior director of MSLs or MedInfo or whatever, you become nose to the grindstone. You don't kind of know what's going on. It's really senior leadership that is monitoring these top trends to see where they're going to go. But now let's bring in the complication. The complication is there's more of these acquisitions, more of these mergers than ever before. And the big guys are not only acquiring the little guys, but, you know, when I talked with a mutual friend of ours now, right, Dominic Albano, earlier this year when we were at one of the DIAs and we were speaking there, he was like, yeah, you know, we're going through another merger. We're going through another acquisition. So it's you think it's easier for the top pharma, but it's just as much change management as anywhere else. So how can, in the middle of let's face it, sometimes in the middle of these various business deals, there's chaos underneath where people are actually doing the business. So how can patient input become business as normal? What vision do we need to cast?
I think that really goes back to the process and the workflow, because one of the challenges that I hear when we work with pharmaceutical companies who are going through, you know, a merger or an acquisition is now you have really these two disparate processes at these two, you know, seemingly separate organizations now trying to come together and create a seamless workflow. And what happens is the standards are different. People's interpretation of how things should be run is different. So I think step one really is some type of unification and having a mechanism in place for ensuring that that process is working. Sometimes, you know, we create processes that actually can stifle our end goal. So, you know, think about what you're trying to achieve. So if you're going back to, which I think is really an important point, patient input and patient centricity, because now patient advocates, patient groups in general are really important stakeholders within the industry. And we saw, we were at the rare disease meeting and we heard from patient advocates. It's critical, right? When you're designing a clinical trial, even when you're putting together, you know, the communication points that you're going to get out to your key opinion leaders. And even thinking about, you know, things like analytics and insights, right? I mean, today we can make an argument that when we talk about the definition of a key opinion leader, it's not really just strictly a physician anymore, right? In the traditional sense, one might even argue that there's patient advocates, there's regulatory experts, things like that. So I think it goes back though to the process. Do you have a good process in place? Do you have uniformity in how your organizations, which are now one organization, are interpreting how they should carry out certain and execute certain things? Because what I've found with companies, especially larger companies where there's a lot of layers, is, you know, you're right. At the higher level, strategically, we know what we want to do. But the problem is in the execution. And it's always that, right? It goes back to kind of fundamental business 101. You have a strategy, you have an idea, but ultimately, if you can't execute, and if you can't get the right people together to understand in a collective way as much as possible where they're aligned, well, and whatever the issue is, that this is how they should be doing, you know, doing whatever it is they're trying to do, it becomes challenging. And I think that's where a lot of these companies that are going through these hurdles are with mergers and acquisitions, what they're facing.
It's really true. And there is a little bit of a disconnect there in terms of this is what we want to do. Correct. This is the strategy. Executing it also does require resources. And I do a lot of business cases for a lot of VPs and chief medical officers so that they can prove the value of their team, especially in medical affairs, when it's seen as a drain because they're not sales, right? And the shift overall has absolutely changed. The shift is in the industry really showing that medical affairs is taking front and center for a value producer for the company. We can't ever claim ROI, but we can claim ROV, return on value. So what's your take on that?
It's a really, I think, a hot point, and it's a timely, actually, a question, because just this week, there was, of course, the ASHP mid-year meeting, and so one of our team members from the ACMA went to mid-year and presented a poster, actually, on the increase of medical science liaisons over the last 10 years, and then the decrease on with pharmaceutical sales reps. So that was a really interesting poster. Really the first time that someone does an actual study with kind of quantitative data quantifying, you know, the increase of MSLs and the decrease of pharmaceutical sales reps in that way over that period of time. And I think that, you know, you're going to continue to see that. You're going to continue to see medical affairs taking a much more, I guess, front and center place when it comes to educating physicians, when it comes to generating data, you know, post-approval. And we see this trend not just in the U.S., we see it globally. So, right. You know, with our organization, we work with a lot of companies outside of the U.S. and teams outside of the U.S., and we see it happening everywhere. We see, you know, especially in Asia, where there's a really fast-growing market there and across the pharma industry, among other sectors, but we see it within medical affairs in the MSL space. And part of that is really, of course, the demand that the stakeholder has, which is they're looking for individuals that have that deep knowledge, that scientific medical background. I think the other element to it is risk and liability, because as you know very well, for pharmaceutical companies, having individuals that really understand the science and can position it in such a way that is really objective,
right,
that doesn't put the company in hot water, that's important. So
right.
I think, you know, and I think it's also a reflection in general of global scientific output. I read an interesting fact the other day that global scientific output doubles. Mm. It doubles every 9 years. Mm-hmm. Think about that. So you need people who are really going to be, you know, very well trained, people who uniformly understand and are benchmarked against some type of a standard in this area.
Yes.
From a training perspective. And I also think, going back to the, I love what you said about return on value versus ROI with medical affairs. I think the key is first companies understanding, you know, how do you define value and how do you define success? How do you determine, you know, and what do you view, again, in a concrete way where you can look back and say, you know what? Yes, our medical affairs organization, they've been successful this year. I mean, how do you define that? I think that's important. But I think ultimately, it comes down to, can medical affairs really achieve those two goals that I mentioned earlier? And if they can, I think generally speaking, you're going to have an organization that's going to be able to bring value to any company that is playing in the space.
Right. And I really can't agree more. I think people need structure and they need training. And when you have real world training, you know, as you've gone through your career in the pharmaceutical industry, or maybe out of it and you've jumped in, then your background and your readiness is going to be different. So a big trend is the fact that all these little biotechs are starting up. They're hiring on people that maybe don't have the type of in-depth training that they would if they had started with a SmithKline Beecham, became GlaxoSmithKline, and been working there for 20 years, right? That's sort of the old way of doing things is go through the industry and in your company, a Merck, a Pfizer, et cetera, and get the nice pension and have a good retirement. People are not like that anymore. They jump around, they change jobs, they change roles, and because of the fluidity and the availability of all these new companies, people can jump into a role, put a hat on that says, hi, I'm a director of medical affairs or a vice president of medical affairs, and really not have a background. Or maybe they came from a TA standpoint, so they know the therapy area, or they know some strategy, but they don't know the functions and the operations such as MedInfo, MedCom, publications, and how to run it all, how to put it all together, how to design the organization. That's something that I see all the time and that people come for me for, oh my gosh, you know, kind of can you put out this fire here? So there's a lot of fires going on in these small biotechs. So the point I agree on is that having something benchmarked against a standard to see that they have a certain level of education in these different areas, can speak to them and know how to put them together, is really critical for the smaller company and for the market value of that company. Because even though the launch is governed by commercial, right, the launch of a product, I see a lot of companies making a mistake of not covering the field with MSLs in their first launch and really getting them on board 2 years, 18 months before, and getting on board their medical affairs teams before. It's almost like, let's put a Band-Aid, we need to hire on medical affairs, and they do that 6 months before a launch, and everybody's like chicken without a head kind of thing, running around.
Yep.
And going in and trying to squash those fires is one thing, but going in to teach what is your role is a complete different thing. I think that's where the ACMA certification can come in, and I recommend it to people. So have you, within the ACMA, have you seen a trend towards more biotechs kind of gravitating to you, or midsize? Where's your market segment?
It's a really good question. I would say it's really been mixed. When I think about like the top 10 pharma, out of the top 10 pharma, we have probably about 7 of them that have board certified their organizations, you know, whether it's smaller teams or larger subsets globally. So, and then we have biotechs that have done it as well, to your point, because of the need. So it's a mix. And I think it's a mix because ultimately, what BCMAS, the Board Certified Medical Affairs Specialist Program, really does is it establishes a benchmark, and it gives people, to your point, that broad skill set and knowledge across all the different functional areas. And I will tell you, it also, I think, brings uniformity, even I would say from a cultural standpoint within medical affairs. So, you know, I've had vice presidents in medical affairs that will say to us, I used the BCMAS program to conduct journal clubs, you know, on a monthly basis with my teams, or I used the BCMAS program to benchmark. Yeah, which I thought was a great idea. That was really, we hadn't thought of that. That was their idea. And, I thought that was excellent. It's like, oh, wow, so that's a great way to apply this so that you can unify the organization. Because now imagine you have an MSL in Tokyo and you have an MSL in New York. They're both going through this program and they're both now being benchmarked against these skills, these standards, these competencies. And now they have a real aligned, uniform understanding of how to apply these different areas to what they do. And that's important. And why do you need it? Because of what you said earlier, which is today, you know, if you think about the medical affairs space, it's grown 300% in the last decade. It's going to still grow 15%, you know, annually is what the data shows. So because it's boomed and grown so much, I think the industry even probably didn't predict that. And in the beginning, it was okay to have people that had the therapeutic area knowledge. With a smaller number of people back, you know, when I started in the late 90s. But today you can't do that because the risk is too high. And what you said is really important. You have so many more companies. You know, so if you look at the data on M&A, I think it's like, 2012, where the number of M&A in pharma just skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. So just in the last 8 years, you have all these different companies sprouting up. You have all these different biotechs.
Right.
So now, you know, the tenure is shorter. So you have different interpretations and different understandings,
yes.
And you have people that aren't as tenured. I would actually argue, dangerous for the industry. I would actually say that not only is it a nice to have, it's really a need to have, because there should be a standard so that when you go from one company to the next, there's at least a general understanding. Okay, if I'm designing a clinical trial, this is what I do. I'll tell you a funny story. One of the companies that we work with, they said something that I'll never forget. They said, you know, I have 10 medical directors of my organization. They're all physicians. They're all very good at, you know, doing a surgery, delivering babies. They're working in women's health, but they don't know how to design a trial. They don't understand, you know, what a Markov model is in HEOR, and that's where they need help. And that's fair, right? It's fair because when you go to medical school, that's not why you go, right? You go because you're looking at a diagnose and treat patients effectively. That's how we train people in medical school. Mm-hmm. So this is why this exists, and I think it meets a really important need.
Yeah, that's really good. And it also bridges the uniformity gap. So if someone is, here's the new biotech, let's just say it's, you know, ABC Biotech starts up tomorrow and they hire someone from Pfizer and then they hire someone maybe from a smaller biotech, like someone that's done so many things in such a short period of time, like an Alnylam. And someone that has had, you know, massive growth fast, put their first product up. But a Pfizer's, someone from a Pfizer mindset or a Roche mindset, they've been used to doing things in a very different way. And the bringing together of these minds, no matter how long you've been in the industry or what type of great training or lack of training you've got, because that's the reality for some companies. It's what I hear from clients all the time. Hey, I haven't been given this. What kind of training do we need? You know, and they really want that. I think that is something that is interesting. I'd like to touch on another subject. You mentioned the top 10. So the top 10 this year in order of total revenue from pharmaceutical segment in US dollars in the billions was Pfizer, then Roche, then J&J, Sanofi, Merck, Novartis, AbbVie, Amgen, Glaxo, and Bristol-Myers Squibb. And, you know, you said about 7 of 10 are on your board. I've worked with at least 5. And you know, you hear Johnson & Johnson. Johnson & Johnson had not the best 2019, right? They got called out a little bit on maybe some practices out there that you were saying, that you mentioned sort of earlier. And that was sad for everybody involved, because for a company that cares so much, you know, there's a mistake that can happen. And of course, the trust level goes down when the public hears that. And yet, I believe there's a lot of really well-meaning people within medical affairs. You are one. I am one. I have worked with thousands of people across the globe that care from a standpoint of being a PharmD, an MD, a PhD, and we really want to put the patient first. But we work in companies where the almighty dollar happens to be something that we have to worry about each quarter. When you know, so how can we best do our job at the highest level of caring with patients involved, and start to bring up the vision higher towards patient centricity, while also creating value in the company to help drive? Because it's like when our company succeeds, we succeed. And not everybody sees things like that.
Yeah, it was a tough year this, you know, for the industry. I mean, the Gallup poll, you know, ranked the industry the lowest among top 25 mm-hmm. industries in the U.S. So it was a tough year. You know, I liked when I was on Fox News, I liked what Varney said about pharma rebranding. And he was like, you know, we need to really look at how does pharma rebrand itself. And I thought that was an interesting way to think about it. Or I think he said pharma is a facelift. And I thought that was mm-hmm. a good way to think about it. You know, ultimately, I think it comes down to being able to demonstrate to patient groups, to patient advocates, that we are, you know, putting our money where our mouth is. We're actually doing something, right? There, a lot of times, you know, we say we're going to do stuff, right? You know, and we could say we're going to do this and that. But ultimately what happens sometimes is we actually don't follow through. Mm-hmm. And I think when I talk to a lot of patient advocates, and I mean, and they were shocked that there wasn't, you know, a uniform credential within medical affairs, given, you know, how impactful we are.
Right.
I think, you know, from their perspective, it was like, you know, we want people who go and talk to our physicians, the physicians that treat our children, our loved ones, to be individuals that are working at the highest standards from an ethical perspective, from a core competency perspective. And I think when you got a company like J&J with the opioid crisis and that whole situation, it unfortunately, it casts a negative light. But I think now, if I'm a pharma CEO at any of these companies that you mentioned, I need to think to myself, what am I going to do now to really show that we're willing to go above and beyond and hold our team, right, our organization to a higher standard, to a higher level? So I think it starts really at the leadership level and taking that action. And I'll tell you something that's really interesting, because ultimately, and this is an area I'm very passionate about, you know, when it comes to leadership and management, ultimately what I find often, you know, more than half of the time, is people are scared to make a decision. People are scared to make a decision. And when you don't have leaders that are willing to kind of take a stand, that's where things can get difficult, right? There's that old adage, you know, if you don't stand for anything, you'll fall for anything, right?
Yes.
And so I think you have to have leaders in place, you know, whether it's mid-level management, senior management, C-suite level, that are willing to take a stand, even when that decision may not be popular. Even when it may not be popular. I've heard, you know, from some mid-level managers, for example, that work with ACMA, where they're afraid to implement, for example, board certification in medical affairs, because they're worried about people, you know, having to go through a certification. Maybe people might, you know, uncover that they're not as effective as maybe, you know, you thought they were. So these are decisions, though, based on fear. When you make decisions based on fear, or you make a decision, or you don't make a decision because you don't want to be held accountable ultimately, that's where I think, you know, you kind of come up against a wall, because now you're not willing to really put your foot down and make the decision, the hard decision that really a real leader needs to make. And I think that's where it starts. So, you know, for anybody listening out there, I would say if you're a mid-level manager, if you're, you know, higher level manager, C-suite level,
yes,
you have a very important role. I cannot emphasize that enough. You have a very important role, very important responsibility. You know, I'll never forget, you met Terry Ellsworth, whose son has Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And I'll never forget what she said to me. She said, "Will, I want the best of the best." Mm. That's why, you know, I support. Yeah, because, you know, think about it. You know, she has an 18-year-old son who has muscular dystrophy, you know, has been struggling. Mm-hmm. She wants to know that the industry that she's relying on heavily to help her son, right? And I'm sure that story, there's many, many, many stories like that across the world, that our industry is doing the best we can. Because ultimately, if you look at the data, over 70% of research in medicine is supported by the pharmaceutical industry. So when I say we have a big responsibility, we really do.
We really do.
We really, really do.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I'll share a personal story with you about, what was it? We're in December now. About 9-10 months ago, my mother died of a glioblastoma. She had brain cancer. She's young. She's 64 years old.
I'm sorry.
And thank you. And I got to see kind of on a personal level firsthand some of the unfortunate things that occurred in the healthcare system. Now, glioblastoma, you know, is a very fatal type of disease, fatal cancer. But, you know, the point is that, I remember with my own, you know, father and my siblings, you know, we were looking for any shred of hope, any clinical trial, any new possible indication, right? So, you know, and I work in the industry. So think about those individuals that don't understand, you know, the lingo, the nomenclature of medicine well, aren't in the industry. Think about how daunting that could be, how scary it could be, because you have a loved one that, you know, you want to do the best you can do for them. And ultimately, you rely on we rely on the industry. Physicians, you know, I was talking to some of the oncologists in my mom's situation, you know, even they weren't, you know, up to speed on all the latest and greatest in the clinical trials. And so I had to go to the companies to really get that information. So we really do play an important role. I mean, we can never, ever forget that. I know we say that sometimes in a cliche way about putting patients first,
right,
but it's true.
Right. And that's such a pain point for so many people in medical affairs, because it's like, is this just a thing we say? But the industry challenge and trend for 2019 is forcing people to put patient-centric healthcare first, to lower these drug prices, make them accessible, to diminish the amount of, you know, foreign counterfeit drugs, to overcome these patent cliffs that have been happening. So with that aside, and with the knowledge that we need going forward, which you've talked about a lot of great stuff, I have one final question. What's your vision for 2020? What is next for our industry? One or two or maybe three points that you see coming that we should be aware of.
I think that technology is going to play a much larger role in the development of drugs, as well as the strategic insights that we gain in terms of our stakeholders. So this is one of the reasons why ACMA, one of the things that we've focused on over the last 6 months is we have our own predictive analytics AI platform. And in the first quarter of 2020, and this is the first time I'm actually saying it publicly, we have our own CRM. And part of that is because we believe that being able to integrate these different technologies for MSLs and medical affairs specifically is critical. Because, you know, like you said, that space is growing and it's going to continue to grow. Being able to make decisions, not just based on how you feel, but on real hardcore quantitative data, I think is going to be more important. And I would even go a step further and say it's reckless if we don't make those decisions based on data. It's reckless. We can't say anymore, you know what, I'm going to choose to work with these KOLs because I feel like they've done a great job before. I feel like this group is a group that we should interact with or use for an ad board or use as consult. Can't do that. It's a risk. So I think having the data in place to say, here's the data, here's what we should, just like other industries do. And you know, when you think about some of the other organizations that are moving into the space, you think about Google, for example, right? So Google, obviously its parent company, Alphabet, with Verily Life Sciences. I think, you know, companies like Google, companies like Amazon, you know, just acquired PillPack a few months ago. I think those companies are actually going to light a fire for all the life sciences industry, right? Because they're coming at it from the other side.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Amazon, like you just mentioned, it's changing the face of pharmacy itself, you know, as well.
Yep.
And so how healthcare goes down for the patients, for people, and how they access is changing. And you know, it's true. We really need to keep up with that trend.
Absolutely.
So that's really good. Any last pearls of wisdom for us, Will Solomon?
Last pearls of wisdom, I would say, I always tell my team at the ACMA, and I believe this at the core. This is one of the things that my mom really believed. She would always say, she was an immigrant to this country, and she would always say, you have to tough it. And what she meant by that is that you need to outwork others. If you really want to make it, you've got to outwork. You've got to be relentless and persistent in a good way. And that's what I would say to anybody listening. You know, whether you're at the C-suite level, whether you're just starting in the industry, let's do the right thing and let's remember that we have a big responsibility.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. You just put goosebumps on my arm. So with that perfect last statement, I will say thank you so much for your time today and have a fantastic 2020.
Thank you, and you as well.
Thank you for listening to the V3 Podcast, part of the ACMA Podcast Series, in collaboration with the Pharmacy Podcast Network. For all of the ACMA podcasts, please go to acmapodcast.com.